Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Supply Chain podcast. I am your host, Radu Palamariu, Global Logistics and Supply Chain Practice Head for Morgan Phillips Executive Search. Specializing in board level and executive search, my job is also to connect you with global experts, thought leaders and executives in all things supply chain. It is my pleasure to have with us today Ed. Ed is basically the MD and CEO of Yoji. He has been a successful technology startup founder with extensive business growth, sales and marketing experience. He was actually the VP of sales and marketing for Southeast Asian startup Imatic, which is a leader now on big data for e-commerce. A company basically that grew to have hundreds of companies around the region optimizing sales through intelligent technology. Yoji is a very successful story, and we are looking forward to finding out more from Ed about his journey as an entrepreneur, how he set up the company, and some of his key lessons. Ed, pleasure, and we're very glad to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me, Radu. Very exciting.
Super. So tell us maybe, and I think our listeners are very keen to find out, tell us a little bit about the story of Yoji, how it started. What are some of the key achievements so far, and just a little bit of history?
Yeah, great. So you mentioned a little bit about Imatic, which is where I was working when I started to think about what became Yoji. So speaking to lots of e-commerce companies around the region, and it was just constant that they were improving their sales, but they didn't know how to improve their supply chains, how to get better fulfillment, how to get things out to their customers. And just kept recurring and recurring and recurring. So it became something that I just took real interest in. Why is it so hard? And most of us think supply chain is quite a simple thing. And when you look into it, it's really a lot different to what I guess most people perceive it to be. It's not just a truck goes to a warehouse, picks up some goods, and then takes it to another warehouse and it gets delivered. Often there's a number of actors and participants, a lot of information moving around. It's a very complex beast. And so when we sort of started to understand what it actually meant, then we looked at, well, what are the technology people doing in the space, and what are the cool kids, as I call it, in the startup land doing, and how's that problem being answered that I see from the e-commerce companies? And when we really looked into it, we were seeing more kind of Uber for logistics models at the time. You know, Uberifying everything was the trend in startup land. And really, when you're looking at someone wanting to move 3,000 parcels a day, those types of models are not helpful. So we really looked at what's beyond that and how do we solve these problems of, you know, the data that we had on e-commerce said that in Indonesia, 70% of online purchases were outside of Jakarta. And just about everyone was focused on last mile technology. So you're creating a technology that doesn't serve 70% of the market. So we took a big interest in that, and we said, well, how do you let people go beyond last mile with technology and do it with efficiency? And that's where we really sat down and looked at what technology was up and coming. And for us, 2.5-3 years ago, was the AI and blockchain piece. So we identified that really to get people to work better together, we needed to also understand the businesses and how they operate in a much, much smarter way, so that we could help and plan and optimize each individual business, which also may be individual actors in the movement of a good that have to work together, that historically had no information on each other, didn't understand each other, didn't trust each other. And then that trust piece came down to blockchain. How do we create trust between parties and logistics? The more we spoke to people in the beginning and the more we speak to people now, it's we don't really trust anyone except ourselves, especially with information and with this cost information, address information, these types of things. So we saw huge efficiencies to be gained through blockchain, and we're lucky enough to get Andras Krzysztof on board, who was a very successful technologist. He's one of the first guys around the world funded by banks for blockchain technology, and he's very successful CTO at Viki.com, which was one of Singapore's, or could still be Singapore's, biggest private tech exit. So we started building and designing what we wanted to put together, and ultimately the whole concept was collaborative networks, not so much sharing economy, which I see as, you know, one person working for a large entity, but how do groups create networks and work together in efficient networks, starting to solve that problem. And that's really what Yoji is all about. What's the fastest way to get something from one point to another where there's multiple participants involved or multiple warehouses involved? And also, how do you work better within your own business? Because everyone has got that cost crunch at the moment. The margins are tiny. So efficiency gains are huge. And then that was the real focus of the business.
Got it. And tell us a little bit about the journey, right? So you started a few years ago. Maybe walk us through the major milestones of the company so far.
Yeah, so we put the business together and raised a seed round with some private investors. We always felt that it'd be a good business to take public. We felt like that this is an industry where logistics people are not necessarily so involved with startups and excited about startups and that concept of, you know, there's guys in a shared office somewhere that would like to run your business. They really want to know that you're going to be around for the next 5 years, 10 years. They want to know that you're a compliant business. There's a lot of trust for them to work with you and a lot of transparency. So we felt like also being in Southeast Asia that being able to go out to market as a public company with that record of compliance would be really helpful. Also, we had some really interesting groups that were interested in funding us for that. So we worked together on this project to take it through the Australian Stock Exchange as a reverse takeover. So that involves get an advisory firm, which will find a listed entity to work with to then do an acquisition of you. Essentially, you roll over into their listed entity and take a majority of the shareholding so that then you can run your business out of the listed entity. So it's quite it's not a simple process, but it's not overly complex. You just have to be able to understand and build a prospectus on your business. What is it? What do you do? Where is it going? What are the milestones over the next few years? And how will you be measured? So that was a good way for us to go in the first sort of probably 3 or 4 months of starting that process. Obviously, we'd agreed to raise about $3 million through that process. So the young business, very few staff. We were able to do that placement, which really got us moving and got us beyond there's a big chasm, I think, in startup land of having to build a proof of concept and monetize it before you can raise proper money, I think, especially in Southeast Asia. So we could go beyond building a little last mile application, go straight towards this big blockchain AI platform, which now we're starting to monetize with some really interesting clients. So that was really great from a finance and operations perspective, but it also from day one put a really strong discipline into our business around finances and accounting, which is a key area that a lot of startups go wrong. Also planning, looking at things like key personnel risk, looking at how you're building your team, how you're reporting against objectives, and obviously it's a very transparent business. So it helps us be very accountable, and it helps us have access to a wide range of capital across markets.
Yes, yes. And in terms of staff, just to kind of have a look at the trajectory, so how did you grow? I mean, now you have about
50? A bit over 50, I believe.
About 50, yeah. Okay. So it's you grew quite nicely. This is in below 3 years?
Below 3 years. So that's about 2.5 years of
operations. And maybe I think what would be interesting, take the time to have some bragging rights. What are some of the key clients that you're already working with? Because I know that you're working with some pretty big entities already.
Yeah, so I mean, one of the first ones we said we were working with was Line Parcel, which is part of Line Air, the region's biggest airline, who've got a very extensive parcel network in Indonesia. We've now recently announced that we're doing work with UPS across Asia Pacific. DB Schenker across Asia Pacific. In Australia, we're doing work with a company called Sealer, which is part of Sinotrans, China's biggest logistics company. So there's lots of really exciting projects in the larger space. But I think also the SME space for us is really exciting as well, because there's thousands or tens of thousands of companies there looking to digitize and get access to new work. And essentially, everything these days runs off an API. And if you don't have that API connection into your business, it's very hard to get new types of jobs from the marketplace. So digitizing logistics companies on the smaller scale is also very exciting for us as well. And we're building up a book of SMEs and guys trying to transform their business or start a new business based on digital technology in the logistics space. So very exciting. And where we see that's important is that there's a very high cost of building technology, and we had a belief early on that if you're going to be a logistics operator or a last mile company, you shouldn't be building your own technology, because essentially 80% of it's the same company to company. Really, you should be focused on getting customers and delivering jobs. And so we were going out to speak to these types of companies that are looking to become digital, become kind of more techie and Amazon-like, if you like, and help them stick to what they're good at and support them where their strengths are.
Yes, yes. And you started a little bit, and I'm happy that you mentioned the story of, you know, going through the stock exchange listing. And I think it's an interesting route, because a lot of startups don't go down that path. And as you said, I think it's extremely important. And I think for the entrepreneurs listening to us, or for the startups listening to us, to understand that that's an option on one side, and also that inbuilt system thinking, also the fact that you really need to get your systems, your processes, your finances right, because otherwise there's no way you can comply, basically. And so it's almost like a rubber stamp to say, okay, this business is legit, all right, and you can trust it. And it forces you to have that discipline early on, whereas I think that's a major challenge for a lot of startups, that because they don't have the discipline early on, as they grow, well, it's a shaky foundation. So it's a very interesting story. So I just wanted to drill a little bit deeper into that point and tell us a little bit, maybe, if there's any other lessons or learnings about the listing on the stock exchange, the maturity of the company, the growing, anything else that you would share with other entrepreneurs.
Yeah, look, I think it is an interesting model. Obviously, it will work for some people, it might not work for others. But where it's really good is that, you know, we have a board of independent directors that are not necessarily there just to take a salary and you know, be part of a growing company. They're there to actually represent shareholders and also to act in their role as a director to ensure that they're doing everything they can to grow the company in the right direction. And that is something where, you know, once a month I go and meet with them and give my opinions on what we should be doing. And their job is to challenge my positions or question whether we've done all the appropriate steps to take that next step in something which we want to do, because there's usually a cost, whether it's people, whether it's money, whether it's all of these things. So the idea that you become, you regulate yourself as well with people that are independent, that have a reputation outside of the business, that are looking to represent shareholders and support the business the best they can. And also, you know, obviously there's that legal aspect of it as well, which you're always working on. But now all of that gives you good process in a business. You have to build a business case to follow a new strategy. And when you're a startup, and right, I'm sure you know, in logistics, there's lots of shiny balls and opportunities everywhere that you can go and chase after. There's so many gaps, there's so many holes, there's so many opportunities to chase with technology that you're forced to really to focus down on the ones that you can be really good at and you can do and build a sustainable business off. So it helps you have people that are not just yes people, but people that will challenge your positions. And then, you know, I think we've got a much bigger platform to tell our story. So one of the hardest things to do as a small company is to be heard and be seen and get known about. You know, so as a company working out of Singapore, you sign a deal with the UPS or a DB Schenker. How do you get word out to people, new investors? You know, in Singapore or in Southeast Asia, you can kind of try and send a press release, and there's amazing platforms like Tech in Asia that do a really good job of promoting companies. But how do you get to a wider audience? How do you get to the funds and institutions that are looking for the next business? So we have our ASX platform where we can go and release our information to, you know, I think the company's now got 6,000, 7,000 shareholders. So that's a group of people that we can talk to on a regular basis and give them an update. And, you know, startup is, you know, I think 50% putting your head down and working really hard. That's 50% being able to explain your story to people and creating a sense of, I guess, excitement and opportunity around the story and where you're heading. And that's a really, it's a difficult thing which a lot of startups, I think, leave behind in terms of what is it that the problem you're solving and where is the opportunity. And it's not the, if we get 1% of this billion-dollar market, we're going to be worth X. It's, this is where what Yoji is focused on, and this is how you can see us taking big steps forward, and you can see the exciting opportunities from the scale of things based on data points along your journey. So we have constant ability to share our story with existing investors, which I think is about 6,000, but also to new funds who are looking for new opportunities to buy in liquid markets, which is exciting. The other exciting thing is for staff is that they have access to a liquid employee share options plan. So, you know, I think many people go into private businesses, get some shares, and at what point are you able to cash out on that that opportunity? Whereas in a public market, you do your time, you've got your shares once you leave, or once you reach your cliff when you can exercise your shares or options, then you have a liquid share in a tradable market. So it's a really positive thing to offer people something that's real and tangible on top of their salary and that excitement around being part of a public company. And so those are really interesting areas where it's that big platform to offer new things to employees, offer new opportunities to people who are investing in public markets that are looking for the next growth story. And, you know, what better place to look at growth stories than Southeast Asia, than logistics? And these are areas that everyone's interested in, I think. So it's a good place to be.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I just have a personal curiosity because I've been an entrepreneur myself, and I consider myself to be an entrepreneur. And I think this is something that maybe comes to my mind, maybe some other people would be wondering. How complicated is it? I mean, was it complicated to do the process? I mean, I'm pretty sure there was quite a bunch of paperwork to be done, but complication and complexity is one thing, and cost is another thing, right? I mean, was it really expensive to do that, or is it fairly affordable?
It's an interesting one. And cost in a startup, as you know, it's got a lot of dimensions, right? It's cost is time as well as money in a startup. So, now, if you look at the average time for a company to raise a $3 million round in the private market, that could involve 50, 60% of the chief executive's time for 6, 8, 9 months of a year. And so it's a different model. You may pay a little bit more to be part of a very structured system, but then you have the ability to already be compliant, audited, and presenting as something that the information is all transparent and validated when you go out to investors. So the process of raising money is actually much faster. All of the information for them to find about your company is there for them, and they can find out just as much if they want to put in a couple of million as if they want to buy $5,000 worth of shares. The information is public. You can do your research. You can make your decision. So it does have an additional cost in terms of money, but it has a lot of savings in terms of time and efficiency, and also the number of different types of funds you can speak to around the world that would be interested in participating, because it's on a regular platform, it's liquid, and these types of things. So it certainly has its advantages in some areas. It's just a matter of looking at your type of business and what you want to achieve. And you know, I think one of the things I've learned across the three startups that I've been involved in is don't start a business unless you know where your sort of Series A, Series B, Series C would come from, and you're speaking to those investors and they're saying, we want to come on the journey with you. I think it's very hard to start and then 3 months in start to look your first funding, not knowing where that pathway is, especially in this region where, you know, it's not like Silicon Valley and the access to funds is a bit different. So you really have to know where that funding's going to come from and prepare your business and come and meet them when you're ready, saying, here's what I said I was going to do, here's where we are now, and let's take it to the next step.
Excellent points. And I mean, I also think that with my knowledge of the market, I think that based on what you're saying, and it's not the common path. I mean, I see this as the less traveled path. I mean, you stand out just because of that. And we do work with some venture capital and private equity funds, and I know for a fact that just like you said, they're very much looking for this rubber stamps. They're very much, I mean, it's easier for them to take a company that has already gone through the auditing process and is already certified in a way by an external entity, right? Rather than, you know, take all the risk and have to do it, and the time and everything that is involved.
It's a big cost to them.
I mean, again, it's very good that you mentioned the two factors, because indeed cost is time and money. So it's a very good point that you make. So thank you for sharing. Very insightful for me, and hopefully for the people that are listening. So moving forward to the next question, because obviously the UOG is a lot about two key elements, right? Blockchain and AI. Do you think blockchain is going to transform the industry?
I think there's too much hype about blockchain, which makes it really difficult to navigate. You know, there's lots of people standing up at conferences and talking about how it will change the world and all of its amazing things. But essentially, blockchain gives you accountability and truth and immutable. So once it's there, You can't reverse engineer it. You can't change it. You can't go back before the time that a hash on a blockchain was put down and say that, no, we'll go back and edit that and change this document to be something else. So that's, it takes out that ability to change things and to do things behind the scenes that people would call illegal or immoral or inefficient. So where it's going to be really good for logistics and supply chain is that there's a lot of places where a lot of people are involved and they either don't trust each other or trust is not enough. So what that means is that a manufacturer and a trucking company don't necessarily have trust that they're going to be, that one is going to pay the other and that one is going to do the job that the other asks. So a blockchain is a way to create presence and history of both companies and show that both have a authentication process, whether it's your history of payment, whether it's your history of jobs completed and on time, whether it's that you've got all of your licenses and your regulations in place and you're manufacturing from accredited warehouses. So these types of things are really important, and where that's important is if I'm moving food across the world and I want to say it's organic and I want to prove that it went through all of the different organic accredited warehouses and it followed the path from the, whether it's Californian almonds that are organic that you're sending into Asia, being able to prove that that's what the item is and then track it through history on a blockchain so it can't be reverse engineered and changed. I think food, medicine, luxury goods would be a huge growth area for blockchain initially because it's very customer driven. So that side of authentication of goods. But then you look at a company like a DB Schenker or a Maersk, and lots of documents flying around the world at any point in time. And it's not just, it's internal, it's external, and there's lots of compliance has to, as a layer on top of that, proving that someone signed up on this and the next step and the next step. And we see, I've heard statistics like the cost of moving a container, that administration is twice the physical movement cost. So there's huge costs in the documentation and labor in Europe, Australia, places where labor is very high and you're spending hours and hours and hours on these bills of lading and manifests, customs clearance, and being able to narrow that down into contracts where everyone can interact with, but then you can't change it once something's happened. So every different actor in the supply chain can contribute and authenticate their part, and then that comes into one document which can be shared with customs on either side and these types of things. So I think it would reduce a lot of the inefficiency in the system, and that's around establishing trust and relationships.
Mm.
It's not going to change how people do things, and it's not going to change at a technology level what is used to optimize or to route or to plan your supply chain, but it will make it much more efficient to do that process.
Yes, yes. Over time, of course, because that will always take time and... new technologies to come and take time. So that brings us to our next question, really. I mean, where do you see the logistics and supply chain technology going?
So I see a lot of pressures coming through the market, and it's more and more from both sides. So, I mean, Alibaba and Amazon have been things that have come very quickly, and you can almost say out of nowhere, at the speed they've grown to the size they have, there's not really examples of that through history of just completely changing the way a market operates in such a short period of time. And I think brands and consumers didn't realize what they were being part of. And brands, you look at a company like a Nike or someone else that's selling on a company like Amazon's platform, who Amazon might be selling it cheaper than what they are, and consumers are saying, well, I want a 3-hour delivery, and they have access to so many more products. So a lot of brands lost control over their brands because of these things. A lot of consumers took a lot of control over logistics. And then you've got the guys in the middle, the logistics companies, trying to work out, well, how does this work for us? And the costs are so low, things are going at such microscopic at the single SKU level. A pair of socks is being moved through this my supply chain, and I have to work out how to get to this customer on time. So you need to change pretty quickly to, if you want to remain part of it, but also if you just want to be good at it, right? So people haven't been able to, historically, they do a lot of outsourcing, subcontracting, and visibility was something that was poor, but it wasn't that important because it would be at a container and pallet level, and you could make a phone call and pretty quickly get an answer. But now there's so many things moving to so many places so quickly, and customers want to know what's going on, that that whole visibility and transparency piece is becoming very important. So being able to get information immediately from your platform about where things are, and also now you have to actually know before the point of failure that something's happening so you can advise and keep your customer service levels up. Your customer wants to be able to see in real time where things are coming. There's all these new stresses on supply chain, and then you've also got to offer things like 2-hour delivery, same-day delivery to keep up with the likes of Amazon. So the technology is moving into this, you know, Uber-like experience where you can't jump on, you can see where something is, you can quickly make a transaction, you can track it, you've got your history. The operators of logistics companies have got real-time data on their network. They can see if they're hitting an overflow point where maybe they need more subcontractors, all of these things. So it's all about picking up agility. And, you know, to give you an example of that, we've got a customer that's got a very large agreement with the Global Express freight mover. And they have that very strict SLA that comes with that, which they're obviously bound to keep or they lose a very big contract. Now, they work with a lot of subcontractors that do a lot of the work for them. And so then their problem is, well, how do we make sure we meet the SLA with people that we can't even see, and we don't really know how much they even care about that SLA, because, you know, we're the business that cares. So you look at ways of, how do I get the visibility of my subcontractor network? How do I help them work smarter? And so they went through a global tender, and we ended up winning that, which was great. But they essentially were looking for a way to push jobs to their subcontractors who were working on the same platform as they were, so they could maintain a single tracking link visibility that the customer had, the recipient had. And so you've got 5, 10, 20, 30 subcontractors using the same platform. So essentially they're an extension of your technology platform without sharing your customer information or your database or your transaction history. So that then you can collaborate in secret, as we call it. And so that's where I really see it going. People are looking not just for the technology for themselves, but how to get full visibility across their network and how to do it quickly.
Yes, I mean, I think that's you hit the nail on the head. I mean, that's fundamentally the one of the key, if not the key issue, a challenge that you know, if you're a 3PL, if you're a shipper, if you're a manufacturer, if you're a shipping line. Even ports, I mean, I was talking to the PSA, the Port of Singapore, they're trying to become much more of a technology and driven company as well. And, visibility, predictability, digital, and having digital access to data in the first place. I mean, there's fundamentally, I think the fundamental foundation is that most of these companies really fundamentally don't have access to proper data, or they can't extract the data at the right level. But then on top of that, you know, if you have the correct data and if you have the technology, if you have the system, then you will have the visibility and the predictability. But that brings us to the next question, because obviously it's almost like teaching an elephant to run like a horse, right? Because you have these mammoth organizations, both on the manufacturing side, on the 3PL side, large, used to operate in a certain way, in a certain manner. And there's a... You can always see there's an inertia, right, in terms of enterprise, in terms of technology, in terms of adoption. How do you see these large companies innovating in debt?
It's really interesting because, you know, there is a perception that they're slow, and often they can be. They don't want to be, for sure. All of them are very working really hard to innovate, and I'm sure you've spoken to a lot of companies. They're very aggressive with technology and trying to do things. And there's a whole heap of new areas where they should be moving and are moving, and that's all defined by the customer. So, you know, one such opportunity you sort of touched on before, you've got 3PLs that are trying to find their space in the new marketplace. Where can a 3PL offer a lot of value to their customers and keep their customers and avoid them going to global end-to-end contractors or to marketplaces and these types of things? And essentially, their customers are also trying to protect their brand. So if you're getting back to a Nike, or if you're a company that even makes alcohol, they want to control that to customer experience as well. So 3PL is actually a big player in you know, moving things across the supply chain, but they can offer that end-to-end support to customers and that branding and that control over an ecosystem that if you went to a marketplace, you don't get. So there's huge opportunities both for consumer ratings and consumer acceptance, but also for brands that are looking for people that work with them. So those things like the innovation strategy projects that come when we talk to them, sort of you can say a lot of ideas about internal efficiencies and it doesn't seem to excite them as much as when you say to them things that their customer will love. And that's this customer first thing, that's where we see that the movement's happening really quickly. So you can go and say, oh, we can, our smart routing will save you 15% on your kilometers traveled, or these are that's really cool. But then you say, but a customer's really interested to see that when your sender ship through your network, they can sign on a digital proof of delivery that's got your logo on it. And so then you can show your end-to-end to that customer. And that suddenly becomes very interesting. And it's the same with your authentication of food through a network. So if you can offer a proud of the fact that you can track their goods through a blockchain and move it into China, and it reduces the number of counterfeits sold because you can authenticate, that's very interesting. So it's about they're all looking to move where the customers are, and then the customers will rush them. And we can see that with Amazon, what's happening. Everyone's trying to adapt to that new marketplace model. So they're doing things like micro projects, looking at their big problems and launching small projects to test out how they can solve those problems. And I think they see that the best way for them to evolve is almost to disrupt themselves, find some good technology, start using it, and let it flow back through the business. And obviously there's a bit of IT team acceptance that's required to get the technology in. But once it's in, letting the technology do its thing and work with the customers, let the customers define what the technology is going to do for them, let it flow back up, as opposed to trying to push it down from those big innovation teams. And there's a lot of stakeholders internally that will make things naturally slow, no matter how fast you're moving. So
absolutely. I mean, that's actually, I mean, historically, not that we as human beings learn from history typically, but historically it's been proven that it doesn't work so many times over, right? And I will not name, but in recent times it was a large company that had a massive failure on their implementation of an IT system that they wanted to design themselves. On the successful side and on the positive side, I think more and more companies are realizing in 3PLs particularly, there were a couple that have kind of started the fund to invest actually themselves into startups. Maersk has one deal. Kunanaga launched something with Temasek here in Asia, where they're trying to spot new technologies, new startups. So, back to your point, you know, they want to disrupt themselves, but they're also, I think, smart enough to recognize that you cannot disrupt yourself within yourself. I mean, you need to have an external, or you need to invest in an external entity that will do that. Whilst on your existing business, just focus on optimizing your costs and all of the normal management type of an existing model.
And I think you actually probably see this much more than I do, that the systems they have, whilst they might be old, they're not necessarily bad. You know, that people love the systems they're working on. So there's that. I understand it and I like it, and I might have been at the company for 20 years, 10 years. Now, I know how this works. I'm comfortable to come and sit at the desk and use the system, and so I don't have a great need to move. And at a executive level, you've got KPIs and these types of things. The big system changes can have a big cost to the business in the short term while you adapt and evolve and test and fail and fix and do all of these things. So there's all of these. It's not just user experience. It's not just where you should be going, but there's that love of sustaining what's happening within businesses where, you know, middle management and users and the guys in the warehouse are comfortable, they're trained, they know how to use the systems they have. So it's that, you know, loving the system is really important. So getting to people where they can use it and test it quickly and get their hands on it, bash it around, try and break it, see how it helps them, and then they begin to adopt it organically. So this is actually better than what I had before and I'm enjoying using it. And that's, we always had in mind building our system something that was plug and play. So essentially it's mobile apps and a web browser and you're up and running, and you can do it with 1% of your fleet, you can do it with 20% of your fleet, you can do it with all of your fleet, depending on your model and how you want to test it within your business. Because, you know, the days of the kind of SAP transformations across the business, especially for new technologies, it's much more difficult to do now. So when people come back to the business and say, hey, we just tried this and we love it, it's a much easier thing to discuss than we're proposing to do this to your implementation of this new technology.
It's an easy sell, absolutely. It's an easy sell. What are some of the key messages you wish you could tell every logistics CEO?
So for me, I think there's this fail fast is something that Mark Zuckerberg has said, and a lot of people read about this, but I think it gets almost to the opposite of that. It says start quickly. That micro project thing that we're just talking about, you know, there has to be a level of approvals about trialing new technologies because you've got security systems and things, but being able to enable your teams to do those micro projects and try things and come back to the business with where the successes were, what they loved, what they didn't like. I think a lot of the time, some of the people with the best information are the guys in the trucks and in the warehouses and these types of things. So getting those guys' information on the table, bring them in for workshops, for whiteboarding, and working with the more agile technology groups, which is something we love to do. We sit with drivers from all of our companies. We sit with the dispatchers because essentially they're the ones that will make or break the success of the project, not the C-level people. So letting people on the ground give you much more feedback and propose solutions, and then tabling all of that and sort of looking at what really does the business need and what are they going to love and what's going to force adoption and, you know, internal disruption, as we just mentioned about. So it's that start fast, speak to the people on the ground, bring the information back up.
Super. I mean, that reminds me, one of my good friends is Charles Brewer. He's the CEO of DHL e-commerce. And Charles is one of the most, I think he's a living exemplification of what you just said. So he started his career in DHL Express many years ago. And now as this year, he likes to go on the back of the motorbike and do the delivery together with his delivery guys himself, because he wants to, you know, to see, to be in the action, to be in the flow. He goes and walks in the warehouse together with the team, has a meal with the team when he goes to a new country or one of the countries of DHL. So I think it's a down up kind of a, you know, you gotta get the information from the people that are actually involved in the business, that are actually doing the things. You cannot only rely on management, senior management, because of course there's a disconnect somewhere, and you cannot be as accurate with what's the actual problem of the truck driver unless you're just sitting, right? So
absolutely, that's a really good point. Absolutely, yeah. I think it's an industry that I don't think people realize the level of detail that occurs down on the ground. I think consumers, the amount of planning and the amount of experience that goes into building these networks, technology would never be able to walk in and replace what people have worked out because they started out the truck driver and moved up and implemented what they learned back down through the management environment. So it's an industry with so many nuances. It's actually quite difficult to build technology for it and understand all the nuances of what happens during the day. And then that's one thing I think was a big surprise to me, once you really get into the depths of it all, how much you really have to understand your users and the difference between them having to take 30 seconds to complete a job in 2 seconds because, you know, they've got to get 200 jobs done in a day and these types of things. So it's really important to go down to what we call the cornflakes, you know, and actually see the very detailed level of how things are operating.
Yes, yes. Moving to the segment, last couple of questions in terms of in terms of people, it's core to any business, and it's even more important, I think, to a startup. Tell us a little bit some of the principles of, you know, how do you hire, how do you look for people, how do you grow your team?
Yeah, so we have taken a reasonably top down approach in hiring. In a startup, you're always thinking about how you scale. So how do you take this business to be 10x what you are now? And often we see people starting with maybe one technology manager and then a lot of kind of inexperienced developers working underneath them. And they build quickly, but they don't think about how this platform will work when it's got 10 times the volume going through it or 10 different types of use cases going through it. So same with your sales environment and your product environment, being able to have people that build teams underneath them that can then scale up if you need to grow. So we've got some very experienced sort of ex-CTO, VP level technology people that are building teams beneath them, and then we can break out those teams into smaller and smaller teams as we go out and expand. But we've always got that ability to plan what we're doing for the future. So getting experienced people in that can run their department really well and build out their department, as opposed to getting a couple of junior people that make a semi-department and then trying to find someone else later on that comes in on top. And then essentially, usually you'll find they'll have to rebuild it because it's not working. So top-down approach and working with experienced people that can then build teams underneath them. And often you can move a lot faster in that way as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you consider yourself a disruptor?
No, I think that's a word early on we really didn't want to use. I mean, I have nothing against the logistics industry or supply chain industry, and I have no need to take them on head on, really. I think there's amazing people, and as you said, Charles Brewer, who's still out with the drivers, and you know, we can't beat what these guys know. What we can do is make them more efficient, and that's our goal. So we really want to work with them. We want to help them, I guess, transform to an extent in terms of moving digital or more digital in some cases, but also just helping them optimize their business through new technology. So sitting with them and looking at how they're doing it now and, you know, improving our technology to improve their business and bringing what we have to go and improve the smaller businesses and give them much wider access to markets and, you know, remove the real price wars, you know, offer value wars and service wars instead, which means that people are much better off in the long run.
Yes. One other question, because obviously we're walking in the offices, the 10 vendors on the wall, and you as the CEO are responsible for the culture of the organization. And I'll mention the first one, which really stuck with me, right? Because it's something to the extent of, you know, spend your money wisely and don't go broke, actually. I think it's don't go broke.
The number one rule.
Number one rule, don't go broke. It's a very important rule in a startup. Yeah, where did you come up with it, and how did you inculcate it in the culture?
Yeah, so, I mean, well, I've been in a couple of businesses before, and in startups, often you can think there's this gravy train of funding ahead of you, and it's never a good way to build a business. You need to be able to build a sustainable business, and, you know, every dollar should count, and I never think about the money that is in my budget or our budget as our money. It's investors' money that they're trusting you with to grow the business, so you have to watch it closely and make sure that you're doing the best you can with every dollar you've been given to execute the growth that I'm after and they're after and our team wants. So just always being humble in what you have within the business and the money you have and making sure that you're not just wasting it because you think there's more. So our business, one of the things we've done is we've really given staff the opportunity to demonstrate that they're the leaders in that. So we don't necessarily come and bring in a lot of policies and say that this is what you have to do and these types of things. We have some of those, but a lot of the time it's the staff that lead that and they're all accountable for each other. So I'm all about kind of team-led culture, and then they essentially define the culture back to the business group. And we haven't seen anyone go wasting lots of money. We haven't seen anyone doing things they shouldn't be doing, and it's supporting them for doing that and not necessarily creating lots of rules and regulations and stipulations that let them feel like they're not trusted. So I think if you trust them and if you demonstrate to them that there's a great opportunity for all of us and letting them meet the investors and things like that, then they feel a much greater sense of responsibility. So I think everyone feels part of that process. No one wants to go broke. Obviously, they have to keep a job, but also they feel the responsibility to look after investors, and they're all excited about making a great big company. So every dollar counts in that sense.
Mm. And if you were to, I mean, obviously, you've had a journey of entrepreneurship, right? If you were to think back when you started, and this question is a question I like to ask, especially for the younger people listening to us and for people that are thinking maybe of starting up, what would be maybe, let's say, two of the key lessons that you would share?
I think there's always going to be people that know more than you. So it's finding as many of them as you can and asking as many questions as you can and then trying to work 10 times harder than they do, essentially. It's all about hard work. I can't see any secrets. You know, there's success stories of guys becoming unicorns in a number of years and these types of things, but behind it all, they're working long hours, they're busting their guts, and they're doing as much as they can with what they have. So, you know, for mostly it's hard work. It is sort of... there's no real secret there, I guess. For me, it's just hard work. And then it's, yeah, as I said before, it's about, I call it attacking from a defendable position. So never grow too fast. Always try and get to a level in your business and make incremental changes in size. So consolidate. If you bring it in, we doubled our tech team throughout this year. And that we made an agreement as an executive team. Let's just stop for a while and let's make this team work really well before we go out and try and keep hiring again. So, you know, it's not just more, it's not more people perform better, it's good teams perform better. So slowing down, consolidating, and then getting a new bunch of good people and training them up. You know, it's really difficult to integrate people. I think people misunderestimate that. To grow a team very quickly is very, very difficult. It's not because people aren't smart or because they're not capable, but the systems of people working together just takes time to smooth out. So you just have to monitor that growth and do it, I think, more incrementally than just continually bring new people into the business.
Yes. Well, and it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us and sharing with us today. For all of you listening to us, please feel free to look up Yoje, Y-O-J-E-E. We will also provide the link to the website on the podcast and on our webpage. Also, feel free to reach out to Ed, and you know, in case you're looking for a job or internship or something, find him on LinkedIn, and who knows, maybe in the future.
Absolutely.
When they're hiring. And want to wish you good luck, keep growing, good luck in terms of attracting much more and more and bigger clients. And I'm sure that you know, in a couple of years, who knows, maybe you'll be the next one.
Do our best. Thanks so much for having me, Robbie. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on radopalamario.com/podcast for all the show notes, links, and extra tips covered in the interview. Make sure also to subscribe to our emailing list to get the news in the nick of time. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes or Stitcher and you like what we do, please kindly review and give us 5 stars so we can keep the energy flowing and get more people to find out about our podcast. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me to stay tuned for our latest articles as well as future guests for the podcast. And if you have any suggestions or any other idea, please feel free to write to me. I respond to all. And also, please make sure not to miss our next episode, where we will be having a few other C-level and top leaders in supply chain joining us. Stay tuned.